with your worldwide news update. Russia says it has arrested a suspect in the killing of a senior military official in Moscow. AP correspondent Donna Water reports.
Russia's security service says it has in custody a suspect in Tuesday's killing of Lieutenant General Igor Kirillov, who was the Russian military's head of nuclear, biological, and chemical protection forces. Russia's Federal Security Service, FSB, describes the suspect as a citizen of Uzbekistan, born in 1995, who was recruited by Ukrainian intelligence services to carry out the killing. Kirillov and his assistant died when a bomb hidden under a scooter went off as Kirillov left his apartment building in Moscow. Just the day before, Ukraine leveled criminal charges against Kirillov, accusing him of directing the use of banned chemical weapons in Ukraine. I'm Donna Water.
Russia said Wednesday that Ukraine had repeatedly dropped white phosphorus munitions from drones in September. Kyiv denied it had used such weapons and said it was Moscow that had used prohibited chemical substances on the battlefield. Rescuers are digging for survivors of the magnitude 7.3 Vanuatu earthquake. They have no water and the death toll is unclear. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
World Vision Vanuatu director Clement Chipicolo expects the death toll to increase.
We anticipate that the number of deaths will continue to go up.
Witnesses have spoken to Australian network AUBC about their experience going through the earthquake that struck Vanuatu on Tuesday. Business owner Damien Bird was in a shopping center when it started. He ran out with all the other patrons. Later, he took stock of the damage.
I drove past a Chinese building yesterday that had shops all at the bottom and it collapsed on top of itself, so those shops no longer stood.
I'm Charles Delatesma.
This is VOA News. Israel has said it has plans for an extended occupation of a Syrian buffer zone. AP correspondent Joe Fetterman has more.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Tuesday toured the Syrian side of a buffer zone in the Golan Heights. Netanyahu has said that this move is meant to be temporary and is defensive in nature. But in a videotaped statement made on Syria's highest mountain, Mount Hermon, Netanyahu said the Israeli presence would continue for some time. He says Israeli troops will stay there until he believes that another actor is capable of coming in and ensuring Israel's security. That is opening the way for a protracted Israeli presence in the area and is sure to deepen fears that Israel is planning some sort of land grab and long-term occupation.
Joe Fetterman for the Associated Press. Fire raged through the rubble in the early hours of Wednesday after an Israeli strike hit a house near Gaza's Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia. Medics at the hospital said the attack was launched right before midnight, leaving at least 10 people dead. The director of the Kamal Adwan Hospital, Hussam Abu Safiya, made a plea for aid. Everyone knows that our hospital has been appealing to the world for more than 75 days, that we need capabilities, supplies, and tools, and that our hospital is barely providing humanitarian services. But we have no choice but to appeal again. Perhaps there will be a listening ear and meets the needs of Kamal Adwan Hospital. The United States, joined by Arab mediators, sought on Wednesday to conclude an agreement between Israel and Hamas to halt the 14-month-old war. On Tuesday, sources close to the talks in Cairo, the Egyptian capital, said an agreement could be signed in coming days on a ceasefire and the release of hostages held in Gaza in return for Palestinian prisoners held by Israel.
Welcome to the International Space Station.
The return to Earth of two stranded astronauts will happen, quote, no earlier than late March 2025, unquote, NASA announced on Tuesday. NASA astronauts Suni Williams and Barry Butch Wilmore, the first crew to fly Boeing's Starliner spacecraft in June, marked 6 months in space on December 5th. Originally scheduled for a brief mission, the astronauts remain aboard the International Space Station after technical issues forced Starliner to return to Earth unmanned. In a press release, NASA said the delay was to allow it to complete processing a SpaceX Dragon capsule to return the astronauts to Earth. A riverboat sank in Western Democratic Republic of Congo, killing at least 22 people after the overcrowded upper deck collapsed, a local official told Reuters on Wednesday. They said the boat was carrying as many as 100 passengers when it sank on Tuesday in Western Mai-Ndombe province. The victims include 15 women, 5 men, and 2 children. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Christina Menenti, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on African News tonight.
With that in mind, right, we also have to obviously talk about the issue of climate change, right? The oceans are warming. The ingredients that contribute to the formation of tropical cyclones or hurricanes in the Atlantic Ocean, as they're known as, you know, those ingredients are being modified by a warming of the planet.
That's Michael J. Allen, Assistant Professor of Climatology at Towson University near Washington, on Cyclone Chido and how weather patterns are getting more ferocious lately. Details coming up. Also, as the world marks International Migrants Day today, the United Nations urges a celebration of their contributions. And games could win the battle against HIV/AIDS. These stories and more on African News tonight. We start with our top story. The death toll has been steadily rising as officials assess the damage and reach areas devastated by the small but powerful storm, with estimates that hundreds and perhaps thousands may have died on Mayotte alone. Shantytowns that were home to undocumented migrants were flattened and many areas were still inaccessible. Only 22 fatalities recorded in hospitals have been confirmed so far from the worst storm to hit the Indian Ocean archipelago in decades. Some victims were buried immediately in accordance with Muslim tradition before their deaths could be counted. An additional 45 dead were killed in Mozambique as Chido made landfall on the African continent. And 13 fatalities were reported in Malawi, with more than 45,000 people affected by heavy rains. So, as we just reported, Cyclone Chido was the most intense storm to hit the French Indian Ocean archipelago of Mayotte in 90 years. Some residents described it as an atomic blast. Authorities fear hundreds and possibly thousands of people may have died. Michael J. Allen, a U.S. Fulbright scholar, is an assistant professor of climatology, geography, and environmental planning at Towson University in the U.S. state of Maryland. In a conversation we had, Professor Allen first points out the reasons weather patterns around the globe are becoming more intense lately.
Yeah, so I think there's a variety of factors. We're beginning to enter the tropical cyclone season for the Indian Ocean. So in that way, you know, some of this is just basic weather processes in terms of declination of the sun and that sort. And so, you know, I think it's unprecedented in terms of the impacts that we saw, right? The lives that were lost and the lives that will be transformed as a consequence. And as you note, right, there hasn't been really a history of this in the past. And so thinking about just emergency management or response recovery, right, a lot of lessons are learned, unfortunately, after these major events. So with that in mind, right, we also have to obviously talk about the issue of climate change, right? The oceans are warming. The ingredients that contribute to the formation of tropical cyclones or hurricanes in the Atlantic Ocean, as they're known as, you know, those ingredients are being modified by a warming of the planet because of heat-trapping gases being emitted. So that's where we find ourselves with sea level rise, with heavy rain events, with anthropogenic climate change. Some of these events are, they're all unfortunate, of course, but some of these events are going to be increasing in prevalence and potentially severity.
So the severity is going to be a way of life. Basically, in that general area, the Indian Ocean, how could it be so intense?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think we can look more closer to home here in the U.S. and our more recent experience with any of the hurricanes that impacted the eastern U.S. over this last hurricane season here in the Atlantic Basin. We can also look elsewhere in the Philippines. I think they were hit by four or five of these major storms, part of the Philippines in the last month or so. And so these tropical regions are prone to hurricanes and cyclones, as they're referred to in the Indian Ocean. And so the ingredients that are necessary, right, you need warm water. So we have a seasonality to that, which is why December to March or May in the Indian Ocean is the tropical cyclone season there. You need, you know, a lack of wind shear. So unlike tornadoes, for example, you don't want the atmosphere to kind of tear apart tropical storms, and kind of, you know, those ingredients set up the stage for a major catastrophic cyclone to impact a region again that really hasn't had any experience. And the location that you highlighted earlier, right, is the poorest in the French island nation states and one of the poorest in the Indian Ocean. And so there's lots of social vulnerability also that exists with respect to hazards or hurricanes, tropical cyclones.
And Professor, the cyclone Chido, the official death toll from Saturday's cyclone rose to actually 22, with more than 1,400 people injured, including 48 critically. Basically, for the future, is there an early warning system related with cyclones to kind of prepare before this devastation comes?
Sure, I'll defer a little bit. I'm not quite familiar with most of my research is not on tropical cyclones, so in that way, I'll defer some of my comments. But I'll draw a parallel, right? We learned a lot of lessons with the Indian Ocean tsunami, that 2008 or whatever year it was, in which 300,000 people were killed because of the lack of a warning system, to your point, with earthquakes and tsunamis, not the same process by any means. And so we learned a lot of lessons. You know, the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean, we have a lot of those warning systems. We have the Japanese Meteorological Agency. We have the National Hurricane Center that really have the eyes to the sky. And in terms of the Indian Ocean, I'm not quite as familiar with those operational systems. My hope would be that if there is not more attention to that region, that certainly those early warning systems can provide not only warning, but also kind of enhance preparations and response, and then ultimately recovery. And so, you know, we can learn. I teach geography, so we can learn from what's going on elsewhere in the world to better inform not only forecasting and prediction, but also recovery, response, and a management post disaster or catastrophe.
That was Michael J. Allen, Professor of Climatology, Geography, and Environmental Planning at Towson University. He talked to me from the U.S. state of Maryland. As the world marks International Migrants Day today, the United Nations is urging leaders and citizens to celebrate the contributions that millions of migrants make to communities and economies around the world. In Kenya, the International Organization for Migration, working with the government, organized the 2-kilometer walk in Nairobi to raise awareness about migration issues and advocate for migrants' rights.
Atak Duang, a 21-year-old South Sudanese, fled fighting in Khartoum, Sudan, to seek refuge in Kenya.
As a member of the migrant community in Kenya, this day is quite tremendous unto us. It brings us all together as migrants. We get a chance to meet, interact, and at least have some eventful activities to be able to live together as migrants. The day, as commemorated, it puts a sense across us that we are here to build ourselves together, in as much as we come from different backgrounds and areas, and we live together as one.
He spoke as he took part in the Step Up for Safe Migration event in Nairobi this week to mark International Migrants Day. The day is meant to not only remind the world of the economic and social benefits migrants can bring to new communities, but also the challenges they face, including discrimination and violence. The United Nations says conflicts, climate-related disasters, and economic pressures drive millions of people from their homes in search of safety or opportunity. Sharon Dimanche is the chief of mission at the International Organization for Migration in Kenya.
To recognize the fact that migrants make a lot of contributions to our own lives. I know in Kenya how we have so many migrants coming in, and we all recognize the contributions of Kenyans. But in most cases, we tend not to pay attention to the contribution, the skills, the knowledge, the innovation that migrants bring in. So the celebration today is intended for us to recognize and remember the contributions by all the migrants.
The International Labour Organization this week issued a report saying migrants usually bring a net economic benefit to the countries they enter and those they left. ILO officials in Geneva said Monday that migrants drive economic growth in destination countries and they support home countries through their remittances. They also say migrants typically fill low-wage jobs that citizens in some countries shun. However, citizens and governments in host countries do have concerns about helping thousands of newcomers, and many fear migrants are competing with citizens for resources like food, water, housing, and medical services. John Borugu is the Commissioner for Refugee Affairs in Kenya.
It is for the top leadership to be able to decide. Now we cannot take any more because we are experiencing more pressure in terms of resources, in terms of security, or they pose a threat of some kind. If we get to that situation, then the country will have to take a decision. In 2016, when the country felt there was a threat to its national interest, the then administration decided through a tripartite understanding, UNHCR, Somalia, and Kenya, to repatriate.
Kenya is an important destination for migrants. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says the East African nation hosts about 750,000 refugees who have fled war and conflict from neighboring countries such as Somalia, South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Burundi. Ambassador Julius Bitok is Kenya's principal secretary at the State Department for Immigration and Citizen Services.
We are doing this celebration in a very special way, ensuring that we make every step to support the migration agenda. Migration is really very, very critical to our nation because clearly many nations have been met by migration, including our country. Migration goes with many things. It goes with talent, it goes with culture, it goes with diversity. And the government of Kenya is really committed to ensuring that we have safe and orderly migration.
Celebrated annually, International Migrants Day provides an opportunity to shine a spotlight on the contributions of millions of migrants around the world. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Local officials and residents say an overcrowded boat capsized on a river in Western Democratic Republic of Congo, killing at least 25 people, including children, and leaving dozens missing. The vessel was believed to have more than 100 passengers on board on Tuesday, and it capsized shortly into the journey along the Fimi River after leaving the town of Inongo. It was the latest such tragedy to strike the DRC. Concerns mounted that the death toll could be far higher. The Associated Press reports Tuesday's wreck was the fourth this year in the Maidombe province, a region surrounded by rivers and where many rely on river transportation. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Yeheye Suhib, in Washington. An official says that the pirates who hijacked a Chinese-owned fishing vessel with 18 crew members off the northeastern coast of Somalia last month are demanding $10 million in ransom. According to the Associated Press, the hijackers have shared photos of their captives surrounded by armed men on the ship's deck on social media. The vessel was hijacked in late November and taken to the Zafan district in the semi-autonomous state of Puntland. The incident underscores the persistent challenges of maritime security in Somalia's waters. Authorities say an investigation is underway. The United Nations says the HIV/AIDS epidemic could be ended by 2030. But patients need to follow their treatment plans to keep the virus in check. Games could help, as Zahir Kasim reports from Johannesburg.
Let's play a game where we learn about our health. Participants wear masks representing different medical terms. Social worker Tandeka Nene explains.
This is my body, eh? It's strong, there's no HIV, no infection, no nothing. This is my white blood cell.
The white blood cell walks into the circle and flexes his muscle. But when HIV steps in, he's bound at the hands and cannot fight infections until antiretroviral drugs come to free him. Participant Joseph Shangila says the game taught him a lot.
It looks like a play, but I found it very serious because now I know now what is the difference between a virus and its causes.
This program is run by the Networking HIV and AIDS Community of Southern Africa. Earlier this year, NACOSA staff completed the Bridges of Hope course, where they learned how to use games like this to teach people about the importance of following HIV treatment plans. A study in the Southern African Journal of HIV Medicine showed that these games are better than home visits alone at keeping patients on therapy. Again, social worker Tandeka Nene.
Through participation and playing games, it's easy to remember because it's all fun and everything, while not being formal and they are there listening and sitting. So this is a different approach which actually works.
Site coordinator and trainer Sepo Sefome uses games to show participants that with clear goals and the right support, anyone can cross the bridge to a healthier future.
If this model can be used and sustained throughout the world, I think people will start understanding things better and they would have a different perspective of certain things like taking treatment, a different perspective in terms of people that are living with HIV.
Peter Lavashia is the creator of the Bridges of Hope games. He says games cater to different learning styles and it makes it more likely the students will remember what they learn.
It's very clear that different people will have different preferred learning modalities. Some prefer visual, some auditory, some kinesthetic. So if we combine all three, then we reach everybody.
The United Nations aims to eradicate AIDS by the end of this decade. Organizers say programs like this could help ensure more people stay on life-saving treatment. Sihle Kasim, VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
In the city of Goma, a group of Congolese journalists are battling a flood of medical misinformation that can have tragic consequences. Reporter Zanem Neti Zaidi has the story from Goma, the Democratic Republic of Congo.
These journalists working in Goma are fighting a flood of false information about war and disease in a region plagued by conflict and health care challenges. Fact checkers at the Congolese publication Eleza Fact fight misinformation like the myth that mpox, previously called monkeypox, doesn't exist and is merely scabies. Aline Kataliko says their work is vital to public health and building trust.
There are rumors about monkeypox that say, for example, that the vaccine is aimed at the extermination of the Congolese people. We are already observing the dangers of these rumors as they can harm the whole community and prevent the disease from being eradicated.
Since 2021, the 25 journalists at Eleza Fact, including Joel Alimasi Kitambala, have been raising awareness about the dangers of misinformation.
To verify facts, we put in keywords, and every time there's a post containing these keywords, we get notification on all of the publication concerned. If they feel the need for it, they assign a fact checker team member who starts working on the organization in question.
Eleza Facts articles are published on their website, shared on social media, and broadcasts via local radio stations to reach those without internet access. A lot of the misinformation involves medical conspiracies similar to the one about mpox. Journalist Joylene Kazimoto reported on misinformation about COVID-19 in these podcasts.
Kinshasa, la ville où j'habite.
In Kinshasa, the city where I live, I noticed a general reluctance on the part of a category of the population to join the fight against COVID-19, as many don't believe in the existence of this disease. Most of the people who are doubtful are those on the outskirts of the city.
Editor Daniel Makeke says these efforts are important in combating disinformation.
Radio stations relay the podcasts, which raise awareness of diseases and epidemics, how to get treatment, the truth behind the treatment, and the origin of monkeypox, etc. In this way, we can reach even those who do not have access to digital technology, who are being helped by the results of the verification work we are carrying out.
Makeke says ELISAFACT project's efforts help prevent the spread of false news, which can have harmful consequences. Zane Mneti Zaidi, VOA Africa, Goma, Democratic Republic of Congo.
A bipartisan effort to protect children from the harms of social media is running out of time in this session of the U.S. Congress. If passed, the Kids Online Safety Act would institute safeguards for minors' personal data online. But free speech advocates and some Republicans are concerned the bill could lead to censorship. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
Social media is again under the spotlight on Capitol Hill. With just days left in this year's session, both Republican and Democratic Party senators are urging the House of Representatives to pass the Kids Online Safety Act. Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn.
We have laws in the physical space that protect children from the harms of alcohol, tobacco, firearms, protect them from cyberbullying, protect them from exposure to sexual exploitation or pornography. In the virtual space, we do not have those laws.
Blackburn is co-sponsor of the bill, the first legislation since 1998 that would provide online protections for minors. But House Speaker Mike Johnson, a Republican, says he's concerned the measure would limit free speech.
I think all of us, 100% of us, support the principle behind it, but you got to get this one right. When you're dealing with the regulation of free speech, you can't go too far and have it be overbroad.
And conservative groups seeking to limit the powers of government agree. Richard Manning is the president of Americans for Limited Government.
I don't trust government officials to arbitrate fairly, because they by design are political. And we've seen what happens when political people weaponize speech. And that is dangerous and it needs to be stopped. So we've got to come up with a better way of enforcing this or put some more guardrails in the enforcement.
Elon Musk, the owner of social media platform X, worked with lawmakers to address concerns about the legislation. Democratic co-sponsor Richard Blumenthal said earlier this month,
what we've clarified is that there's no censorship in this bill. There's no content moderation. There's no blocking of specific content. It is about choice, giving young people choice and their parents safeguards, tools to protect their children.
Tech companies Meta and Google oppose the bill. President-elect Donald Trump has not expressed an opinion on the issue, but his son, Donald Trump Jr., posted to X saying, quote, "We can protect free speech and our kids at the same time." Manning says the legislation being considered would not work in practice.
State attorney generals would have an opportunity to take whatever the guidelines were, the regulations put in place by the FTC, they would be able to then use those guidelines to determine speech within the context of their state. And you would eventually have 50 different internets in 50 different states.
An earlier version of the bill passed the Senate by a vote of 91-3. Supporters are encouraging the House to vote on the legislation before the end of the year. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Thanks for choosing The Voice of America.